Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable, hosted by Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Dorothy is a nationally recognized benefits and compliance consultant and group health broker. Here, you'll listen to industry experts break down the latest news and trends in employee benefits, healthcare reform, regulations and compliance, all designed to empower executive decisions.
Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable. I'm your host, Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. I want to welcome today's guest, one of our favorites here at the Roundtable, Marilyn Monahan of Monahan Law Office. Welcome, Marilyn.
It's great to be with you here today, Dorothy, to talk a little bit about this very important topic.
Can you believe we're in season 5 already? I can't believe this. Looking back, you've been my most frequent and most requested guest from our listeners, and that's so great and it's so wonderful. Thank you for always supporting us.
It's my pleasure. I really enjoy these chats and educating attendees on employee benefits and compliance, my passion and yours, which might be sad to say.
I know. We're these compliance geeks, you and I. Well, we have a lot to talk about today, so let's get right into it. This podcast idea came from our June 20th, 2023 webinar on the Department of Labor and EBSA cybersecurity guidance for plan fiduciaries. After that webinar was over, I immediately asked you if you'd like to come back this season early and talk about the current state of fiduciary liability and responsibility and dangers. So let's start off with the basics, you know, for the benefit of those who did not attend, of course, our June webinar, and for all of our listeners. Before we talk about the specifics of fiduciary liability and dangers, we need to talk about ERISA, which is where this all came from. Can you give our listeners a bird's eye overview of ERISA? What is it, and what is it designed to protect?
I'm happy to. The ERISA stands for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. It's a federal law that governs the administration of employer-sponsored pension and health and welfare benefit plans. It applies to plans sponsored by private employers, whether large or small. It doesn't matter what size you are, even if you've got 10 employees, technically ERISA does apply. It does not apply, however, to plans sponsored by state and local governments or churches. I should add that I do know that a lot of administrators of state and local government plans and church plans, although they're not legally obligated to follow ERISA, do use it as a best practices standard. So they may anticipate or expect their service providers, for example, to meet certain ERISA standards in order to make certain that they are administering their plan in the best possible manner for the benefit of their participants.
Yeah, and I've seen that as well. Thanks for bringing that up. ERISA benefit plans, of course, include pension plans as well as welfare benefit plans. Can you tell us what types of welfare benefit plans fall under the ERISA jurisdiction?
Yes, absolutely. So as you mentioned, you can sort of divide ERISA's jurisdictional responsibility into two categories, pension plans and health and welfare benefit plans. And the types of plans that fall under the health and welfare benefit plans category can be quite broad, broader, for example, than you see under the HIPAA privacy and security requirements. So the types of plans that qualify as a welfare benefit under ERISA would include major medical plans, dental, vision, prescription drug, life, short and long-term disability, health FSAs, health reimbursement arrangements or HRAs, prepaid legal, as well as certain wellness programs and EAPs or employee assistance programs.
Thank you very much. Let's talk about federal oversight. What federal departments oversee what?
So the Federal Department of Labor oversees implementation, administration, and enforcement of ERISA. Specifically within the Department of Labor, the agency that enforces ERISA is the EBSA, the Employee Benefit Security Administration. But I should mention that when Congress passes new laws, they sometimes include those laws not only within the ambit of ERISA, but they will also add similar or parallel provisions to the Internal Revenue Code and the Public Health Service Act. So although the Treasury Department and the Health and Human Services Department, which are in charge of implementing the Internal Revenue Code and the Public Health Service Act, don't have direct authority over implementing ERISA, some of the same laws will pop up in all three places, giving all three departments some say in how these new laws are implemented and applied. So some examples of that are the CAA, the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, which you and I have talked so much about, and all the new provisions affecting health and welfare plans. Those have been incorporated into ERISA, but they've also been incorporated into the Internal Revenue Code and the Public Health Service Act.
Well, thank you very much for all that background. Now, all ERISA-covered benefit plans are required to have fiduciaries. So what are the various fiduciary roles under ERISA, both named and functional? Why don't you explain that for our listeners?
This is a very important aspect of ERISA, and it's not always well understood by the employers who are putting together a health and welfare benefit plan or a pension plan. What does it mean to be a fiduciary, and what are the requirements surrounding our fiduciary obligations? But let's start with who is a fiduciary. And the first category are the named fiduciaries. So under ERISA, every plan should have or must have named fiduciaries. And these individuals or entities should be specified in the plan document. That's one of the reasons you would draft a wrap plan document to include the named fiduciaries in that wrap, and what could also be named in the SPD. Now, a fiduciary could be an individual person, or it could be an entity, or it could be a committee. Now, in addition to the people who or entities who are specifically identified as fiduciaries, some individuals or entities may be deemed to be fiduciaries because of the services they provide. And so these are functional fiduciaries. They aren't named as such in the documents, but they are performing certain fiduciary functions, and therefore they are deemed to be fiduciaries and have fiduciary responsibility. So it's not... For that category, it's not about what you call yourself. It's about what roles you're fulfilling. In fact, if you are a functional fiduciary, you might even have a contract term that says, no, I am not a fiduciary. But if you turn around and actually perform fiduciary functions, you will be deemed to be a fiduciary. I'll pull a quote from a DOL guidance document on what it means to be a fiduciary for a health plan. And it says, a person using discretion in administering and managing a plan or controlling the plan's assets is a fiduciary to the extent of that discretion or control. Thus, fiduciary status is based on the functions performed for the plan, not just a person's title. And with that, I'll add, where I took that quote from is a guide issued by the DOL called Understanding Your Fiduciary Responsibilities Under a Group Health Plan. So that can be a helpful overall review, what it means to be a fiduciary and what your responsibilities are as a fiduciary.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. I actually have copies of that that I kind of carry around in my briefcase when I'm out on appointments for, you know, first-time clients or for prospects, because they may not understand, particularly if they're self-funding their health plan, they may not understand their true roles as a fiduciary and what that means. So I actually carry that guide around. It's very helpful. As you know, from my entire career, I've often stated, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, acts like a duck, it's a duck. From a fiduciary standard, what does this mean?
To me, what it means is if you are performing the functions of fiduciary, you will be deemed to be a fiduciary, even if you don't call yourself one.
Yeah. So watch what you're doing, not just what your title is.
So I will say that it is important that, for example, if you are a service provider and you do not intend to be a fiduciary, it is important and helpful to put right in the contract, we are not the plan fiduciaries. But having done that, then you need to be careful as to what functions you perform to make certain that you don't fall into the category of a functional fiduciary by taking on more responsibilities than you intend, and therefore end up being deemed a fiduciary when that was not what you wanted to have happen.
Right, for sure. Let's talk about the four main fiduciary duties under ERISA, which is, I believe, Code Section 404. What are those in short?
So first, there's the duty of undivided loyalty to plan participants and beneficiaries. This is sometimes referred to as the exclusive benefit rule. And what it means is a plan fiduciary must act for the sole purpose of providing benefits to plan participants. One aspect of this rule, just to give you an example, is only pay reasonable plan expenses. A second fiduciary duty is the duty of prudence. This used to be called the prudent man standard of care. We now call it the prudent person standard of care. And it means that when you are performing fiduciary functions, you should act with the care, skill, prudence, and diligence under the circumstances then prevailing that a prudent person acting in a like capacity and familiar with such matters would use. Now, the Department of Labor has stated that in satisfying this standard, they recognize that some fiduciaries won't have expertise in certain areas. We use this example during our cybersecurity webinar. If you are, a CFO, for example, you may not be an expert in cybersecurity. So what the DOL emphasizes is you don't have to be an expert in everything, but you do have to reach out and get help. And in fact, they recommend you reach out and get help for those areas where you are not an expert and you need some assistance and you need some guidance from outsiders.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I agree with you 100% as far as cybersecurity. That's a really good example of that. I'm sorry for interrupting, but please continue.
No, that's perfect. And there are other areas where you may not be an expert. In that case, it's perfectly appropriate to ask questions, find help, and retain the experts who you need in order to make certain that you're meeting all the fiduciary functions required of you and providing good level of service to make sure your plan participants are served well. The last two fiduciary functions are the duty to diversify the investments of the plan. That obviously has more impact in the retirement plan field than in the health and welfare plan field, but it can particularly impact those employers who have self-funded plans and may have reserves and need to handle those reserves prudently. And the final item is duty to administer the plan in conformity with the governing documents. And that's a very important one. It may seem obvious, but it isn't necessarily. And what it means is, and the reason I say it isn't necessarily obvious is because so often employees will come up to the employer and say, hey, I goofed. Can you make an exception for me? Can you do things a little differently for me than the plan documents say you should? And that's one of the areas where you can get into trouble, making exceptions for people, even though you may feel it's what you want to do. It may not be what you may be allowed to do, because you could, for example, put reserves in jeopardy. You could put the stop loss coverage in jeopardy if you deviate from the plan documents. The stop loss carrier might not be willing to pay up. You could face claims that you're discriminating against one employee over another. You're favoring one employee over another. So it is important to administer the plan in accordance with the governing documents. When you get a question, when you have a concern, go to the plan documentation first. You might find the answer to what you're wondering about right there.
Right. I agree with you wholeheartedly on that, particularly the exceptions to the health plan regarding the stop loss provisions, because I, as you know, I work with a lot of self-funded employers, and I always caution them if they say, well, maybe we'll make an exception in this circumstance. And I always tell them, understand that if you do that, you do have liability here, discrimination, all sorts of other things, but most importantly, it most likely won't be covered by your stop loss carrier. And once they hear that, sometimes they say, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't make that exception after all. So it's really important that they understand truly what these things mean. So thank you.
And the reason that occurs is typically a stop loss contract says that the stop loss carrier will pay in accordance with the plan document. And if you deviate from the plan document, then they will have grounds to say, but you didn't pay in accordance with the plan document, and therefore we don't have to reimburse you in accordance with the plan document.
Absolutely, 100%. Well, in 2021, the Department of Labor and Employee Benefits Security Administration released three sets of fiduciary guidance, as you talked about briefly earlier, on cybersecurity, which made it very clear that they now expect plan fiduciaries to take cybersecurity seriously and have a plan in place to protect plan assets. There have been questions about whether or not this applies only to pension plans or to all ERISA plans, including health plans. Can you please clarify this?
Absolutely. While the focus of the guidance released by the Department of Labor was on retirement plans, the Department of Labor takes the position that plans must take cybersecurity seriously, basing this on the fiduciary standards, specifically two of the ones we talked about earlier, the duty of undivided loyalty and the duty of prudence. And those two standards apply equally to retirement plans and health and welfare plans. And so that means that whether you are administering an employer-sponsored retirement plan or a employer-sponsored health and welfare plan, you must meet the same fiduciary standards. And that means these days you must meet the same cybersecurity standards as well.
Right. So what are the basic requirements fiduciaries that were laid out in that three-part guidance?
So as you mentioned, there were three different guidance documents that were issued. One was a set of online security tips, which actually wasn't directed so much at the plans, but at the participants, giving participants some guidance on how to keep their data secure. The second guidance was on tips for hiring a service provider with strong cybersecurity practices. A lot of employers do minimal in-house administration, but instead outsource most of the administration responsibilities to third-party service providers, a TPA, a broker, an actuary, lots of different outside service providers. And the emphasis on that document was to explain to employers that when you outsource to a service provider, you need to make certain that their cybersecurity standards are what they all that they should be in order to protect your participants' data. And then the last item that we should be cognizant of is a cybersecurity program best practices document. And this is focused directly at employers and the types of things that employers should do to make certain that they have a good cybersecurity program in place. So for example, one of the first things that you should do is conduct risk assessment to find out where your vulnerabilities may be, to find out where your plan information may be, and to then develop a written and well-documented cybersecurity program to address those vulnerabilities and try to mitigate the risks to whatever extent possible. The next thing is to conduct annual risk assessments. And in fact, those risk assessments might have to be conducted more frequently if you're particularly, for example, if your systems change or if you have any major overhauls or even minor overhauls that might lead you to the conclusion that you better make certain that things are still operating as they should be and that new vulnerabilities haven't opened up. Another thing they recommend is a reliable annual third-party audit of security controls, to have clearly defined and assigned information security roles and responsibilities, have strong access control procedures so that you make sure you know who is accessing the data, who can access the data, and making certain that those who can access the data only access that amount of data that they need in order to perform their job. You don't have to give everyone 100% access. In fact, in most cases, it's more appropriate to limit access to only certain types of information. For example, let's say payroll only needs enrollment and disenrollment information. That means payroll doesn't generally need to have access to claims data, for example.
Right. I want to just point out, because what you were talking about there, basically, if you've taken any privacy and security training, that's very similar to the HIPAA minimum necessary requirements. So I just want to make mention of that.
Absolutely. It's the same concept, but in this situation, it's just applied under the auspices of ERISA as opposed to under the auspices of HIPAA. And to do a little side note here, just remember that while HIPAA security and privacy is absolutely critical, the ERISA cybersecurity standards, they're a little different because they're administered by a different department, the DOL, as opposed to HHS, and because they come under a different set of laws. But another reason they're different is because they are potentially broader in scope than the HIPAA privacy rules, which apply to covered entities and PHI that is related to the employer's health plans. ERISA, for example, applies broader than just to health plans. It also applies to life, short and long-term disability, and so forth. So these ERISA rules potentially have broader application. They also want to see good encryption practices with regard to data, whether it is being stored or in transit. That's a concept we talk about in HIPAA training, but it also applies here. Remember that you are concerned about storing of the data and where it's stored and how you need to protect it when it's being stored, whether it's in the cloud, whether it's on a server, whether it's on a hard drive. But you also have to worry about it when it's in transit. You also have to worry about when it's being transmitted electronically, for example, and then I will take it to a more mundane level when it's being transported. So when you're walking around with a cell phone, a smartphone, when you're walking around with a laptop, all of those kinds of matters have to be addressed as part of your cybersecurity best practices. And then finally, they want you to have a plan in place so you know how to respond in the event of a cybersecurity incident or breach.
Right. And that's kind of consistent with HIPAA as well in a lot of ways. I want to go back to one thing you said several minutes ago when you first started talking about this, about the online security tips. I just want to mention that what I started doing when that guidance came out, I started actually in our open enrollment meetings and in all of our HIPAA trainings for all employees when we're giving them HIPAA training and particularly electronic security training. I have started to hand those out and discuss them with the employees to make sure that they're responsible for, you know, protecting their own passwords and all that sort of thing. So I just want to mention that's something that you might want to think about as your open enrollment season is coming up here for a lot of you. That's something that you might want to think about handing out as part of your open enrollment and part of any of your HIPAA training for your employees as well, because it's a really good document. And that, as you mentioned, that is a document really more designed for the plan participants than for the fiduciaries. But the fiduciaries obviously are responsible for making sure that that information gets to the plan participants.
I think that's a great idea because, you know, an employer can have a great cybersecurity program in place, but if their participants start handing out their passwords, that all goes up in smoke.
Right, exactly. So, well, you mentioned this, but I want to come back to it because it's really important. One of the guidances was on service providers. The Department of Labor, EBSA, now requires that fiduciaries use service providers that are cybersecurity compliant and requires monitoring of them. Would you care to tell us the basics of the fiduciary requirements for service providers and for monitoring?
Absolutely. And hiring a service provider and monitoring a service provider goes beyond cybersecurity. It is a basic fiduciary function that ties in with your duty of loyalty and your duty of prudence. Choosing a service provider in and of itself is a fiduciary function. So you need to make certain that you conduct the due diligence appropriate to ensure that you're hiring the best service provider who will provide the best level of service at the best cost for the benefit of your participants and beneficiaries. That usually requires looking at perhaps a variety of candidates so that you make sure you understand what kind of services are available out there in the marketplace, what level of services are available, what the new technology might be available, and what the various costs are. If you only talk to one person, you might not know that there are different ways to approach costs. So the kinds of things that you might want to consider when you are looking to choose a service provider is looking at a selection of different service providers so you can compare and contrast the level of services and the costs that they might be providing. And it can go into other items, for example, the level of technology that they can bring to bear, the whether or not they're going to provide more one-on-one service, more customer-friendly service that your participants might prefer. You're going to want to look at their experience level. You're going to want to look at their costs. You're going to want to look at their performance history, and you're going to want to look at their reputation in the industry. Also, keep in mind that if they are in an industry that requires licensure, that they are fully up to date with their licenses, their ratings, and their accreditations.
Right. Very well said. And keep in mind also that you need to be, when comparing and contrasting these, you need to look specifically at the fact that they are putting in security protocols specific with the DOL guidance, that they have to have cybersecurity programs in place. So that's really important. One of the things that I've done, as you are aware, and we talked about in our webinar in June, was I created a questionnaire that our clients and people on our webinars and so forth would have that they could actually send out to the service provider so that they made sure that when comparing and contrasting, that everyone was getting exactly the same questions and that they would respond and so forth and provide proof in certain circumstances. And then they could be ranked. You could say, you know, we went out to four service providers for this function, and, you know, this is how they responded to each of these questions, and then we were able to rank them. So that way you would have documentation in your files as far as why you made the decision that you made. Because, again, one of the things that they made very clear in this guidance is that you don't want to necessarily choose your best friend or your golf buddy or your college roommate, things like that. You want to be able to document and prove in the event of an audit or something that you chose the right service provider that's going to do the best job for your plan participants and for your plan. And the decision wasn't made simply because they were your golf buddy.
And can I add just a couple of things on that? We could go back and forth forever on this particular topic. And one is, I've emphasized in my little chat here the steps you should take when hiring a service provider, but you also have to monitor that service provider. Don't just find a service provider, hire them, and then, you know, sort of wash your hands and think, well, we're done for the next 10 years. No, you need to do some ongoing monitoring of your service provider to make certain that they continue to provide the best services to your group. That might include following up with your plan participants, conducting surveys, listening to complaints, or listening to compliments on, yeah, these people are doing a great job for us, as well as auditing them and also tracking what the costs are in the marketplace and what the level of service out there is in the marketplace. Are they keeping up with the best technology? We should talk about costs a little bit. The lowest price service provider isn't always your best option. The Department of Labor is aware of that because they might not provide the best level of service. At the same time, the highest priced doesn't necessarily mean they're providing the best level of service. You really have to do a good hard look at what they're charging you, whether or not it's consistent with what's out there on the marketplace, and whether or not it suits the needs of your plan and your plan participants. And finally, to follow up, Dorothy, on your tips about the tools that you use and the checklist that you use when you're looking at service providers, I'm going to sum that up in one word: documentation. You want to be able to document that you did your due diligence so that if you're ever challenged in an audit or in a lawsuit, you can say, no, we took these steps to make certain we were getting the best service provider that we thought was available to service the needs of our participants.
Very well said. Well, we're going to be taking a lot deeper dive into this when we have an upcoming two-part podcast on the Department of Labor cybersecurity guidance coming up in October. So stay tuned for that. I think that's going to be great. That's going to be you and I, as you know, Marilyn, and also our technology partners, Ted Miyashiba and Ted Flitner from Aditi Group. So that's going to be a great podcast. So if you're interested in this particular topic within this podcast today, we'll get more into that in October. So stay tuned for that. Let's talk about the fiduciary compliance pitfalls and the dangers for a fiduciary. Can you tell us some of the most important and significant pitfalls for a fiduciary in today's world?
Well, there can be quite a few of them. But here's my bottom line, because we've been talking so much about cybersecurity. According to the Department of Labor, responsible plan fiduciaries have an obligation to ensure proper mitigation of cybersecurity risks. And that's a quote taken from the guidance that they recently issued. So what do you need to do in order to do that? We talked a few minutes ago in some detail about some of the steps you need to take as outlined in the guidance. Summarizing that, I would say conduct a written risk assessment, draft a plan, implement the plan, and then follow up. This includes taking actions internally, but also providing or requiring that your service providers do so as well. And that guidance that I keep referring to can be a good starting place to move forward.
Right. So if you're offering an ERISA plan of any kind, there are risks to fiduciaries if they don't do the right thing. Can you give us some examples of those risks and what to avoid?
Certainly. There are various risks that or various consequences that could occur if you do not fulfill your fiduciary responsibilities. Those could result in participant losses. They could result in audits from the Department of Labor, or they could result in lawsuits being brought for breach of fiduciary duty. And those lawsuits could result in personal liability of the plan fiduciaries.
Yeah, thank you for that. I want to make sure people were aware of that. Tell us about ERISA prohibited transaction rules. What do these mean?
Yeah, this is an important item to talk about. We kind of alluded to this earlier when we talked about who you can do business with and whether it's a good idea to do business with your college roommate or your brother-in-law. No, generally. So what is a prohibited transaction and what is it all about? Under ERISA, certain transactions are prohibited to prevent dealings with parties, referred to as parties in interest, who may be able to exercise improper influence over the plan. At the same time, there's also a prohibition on fiduciaries engaging in self-dealing. So one of the first things to do is identify who the parties in interest are. The parties in interest generally cannot do business with the plan, and you cannot have transactions with them. And then once you've identified the parties in interest, however, the next step is to determine whether or not there is an exemption permitting you to do business with that party in interest. Because how ERISA is drafted is there's a general prohibition on transactions between the plan and parties in interest, but they have also built in some exceptions to that rule. And if the transaction you have in mind with the party in interest you have in mind falls into the category of one of the exemptions, then you can go forward and do that. So, for example, let's say you had a large self-funded plan and you needed office space, and you wanted to rent that office space from the employer who happened to be a plan fiduciary. The employer is a party in interest. That would be a prohibited transaction because it wouldn't be clear or easy to determine that that's going to be an arm's length transaction. The employer, as the fiduciary, could bring pressure to bear on the other plan fiduciaries to agree to this leasing of the employer's office space, and that may not be on the best terms and conditions. So that's one example of a potential prohibited transaction.
Thank you for that. That's very important information. I want to come back to this, even though we talked about it earlier. I want to come back to it because I think it's so important. What are the risks if a fiduciary fails to fulfill their duties to the plan?
Well, as I indicated, there could be quite a few potential risks and consequences for failure to perform your fiduciary duties. You could find yourself on the receiving end of a lawsuit. You could find yourself on the receiving end of an audit from the Department of Labor. There are civil and criminal penalties, and then there are participant losses. So that's the heart of why you don't want to have fiduciary breaches. You don't want to harm your participants and beneficiaries.
Right.
So those are the things that the rules are designed to protect against, and those are the consequences that could occur if you step over the line and don't fulfill those obligations you're supposed to fulfill.
Yeah, thank you for that. And as you know, I've done past work and have a couple of current situations as well where I've worked for entities, including the United States Department of Labor, as being an independent fiduciary and a consultant, basically going through this type of scenario and helping the DOL determine whether or not people were acting in the best interest of the plan and so forth. So I have personal experience in this, and I will say from my own personal experience that it doesn't always go well. It doesn't usually go well for the fiduciaries that breach those things. So keep that in mind. The Department of Labor takes this very, very seriously. Like I said, they hire experts to help them with these things and what is normal and what should have been done in these circumstances. And I consider it an honor that they've chosen me on more than one occasion to do that type of work for them. So this is serious stuff.
Let me add that bringing a few pieces of that puzzle together, it is serious stuff, and it is important. And again, I'm just going to mention the word documentation. Make certain that you document the decisions that you're making, the reviews that you're conducting, the audits, the beauty contests when you're choosing service providers, so that again you can establish that you did your due diligence, that you took your job seriously, that you made every attempt to dot every I and cross every T, and so you can establish the reasonableness and the prudence of the decisions that you're making.
Thank you for that. So, what has the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021 done related to the fiduciary duties for health plans?
Well, if you've listened to some of our earlier podcasts or some of our earlier presentations, you know that the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, which we've been referring to as the CAA, was a huge piece of legislation, and it had a major impact on health and welfare plans. There were a lot of provisions in that law which required new actions on the part of plans, insurance companies, and fiduciaries. One of the items that I want to emphasize here that specifically went to the heart of fiduciary responsibilities is that it amended the prohibited transaction rules to create a new reporting requirement on service providers. This reporting information gives fiduciaries more information they can use to assess service providers or potential service providers, which is a good thing. But it also creates grounds for lawsuits by participants if fiduciaries are not using that information and other tools at their disposal to ensure that service providers are providing an appropriate level of service at a good price.
Well, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. One recent health plan requirement for fiduciaries is the prescription drug reporting. You and I know we were very, very busy this past year. So learning about this and helping our clients comply with this law, it was ridiculously complicated. For our listeners, I know we laugh now. We certainly weren't laughing a year ago. For our listeners, can you summarize the requirements of the RxDC process and what plans were and are required to do going forward?
Yes. So the first filing deadlines fell in first December of 2022. That was pushed back to January of 2023. And then the next filing deadline was June 1 of 2023. And this is going to be an annual requirement. So every year plans, whether they're fully insured or self-funded, whether they're large or small group, whether they're grandfathered or not, must report certain specific data about prescription drug costs and usage, as well as premium costs and premium contribution breakdowns between employers and employees. The reporting is done on a calendar year basis. Even if you have a non-calendar year plan, you have to report this data on a calendar year basis and must be reported by each June 1. So for example, the 2023 data will be reported on or before June 1 of 2024.
So do plan fiduciaries have a risk here if they haven't done this reporting?
Yes. Now, interestingly, the departments who are enforcing this, DOL, HHS, and Treasury, have been very vague about enforcement of this new mandate, how they will enforce it, and what the potential penalties will be. However, they do have the power to enforce, and I believe, based on my research, they have the power to impose penalties for failure to comply, or if you do comply, but you comply with incomplete data. Like all mandates, plan fiduciaries need to take this seriously. And as the Department of Labor says, if you need help, get help.
Yeah, for sure. I know that I don't know what our clients would have done had it not been for us, because fully insured plans have it a lot easier, because if you respond to their questions, for example, this past year for the 2023 filing, which was for the 2022 or calendar year, most carriers sent out questionnaires in January, February, or March of 2023 and said, if you answer all of these questions and give us this information, then we'll go ahead and do your filing for you. If you don't, then you're responsible for it on your own. And a lot of times employers didn't realize that was important. They didn't read that email. They passed it on to somebody and didn't follow up and that sort of thing. And now we're getting close to the deadline and they find out that they didn't answer those questions. Now what do we do? Well, we assumed that would probably happen. So we went ahead and we asked all of our clients, if you get those emails, forward them to us to handle. So we would do it for them, respond back to their carriers. But there are still one or two always that still don't even do that. So what we did is we went ahead and filed, even for the fully insured plans, our own filings, because the fully insured are pretty easy. It's basically two files that have to be submitted. It's not that complicated, but it's a process, and you have to go through a huge process just to be an approved submitter. As you know, Marilyn, it took us nearly 5 months to get approval to be submitters in the portal. So this was not an easy thing to do. And then for our self-funded plans, of course, it was much more complicated. They had a lot more data that they had to file and rely on their third-party administrators and their pharmacy benefit managers and so forth. So this was a very, very complicated process. And I can't remember exactly how many webinars and seminars you and I had on this. But it was complicated, and I just remember people just responding and saying, I don't even believe this is happening. So this stuff, you have to take this stuff seriously. This is really, really important stuff. So if you did miss this past June 1st deadline, which was for the 2022 plan year, please go ahead and still submit that if they'll let you find a submitter. I know we're submitters for our clients, and we even did it for some of our broker friends that needed it done, and they knew they couldn't get approval in the, to be a submitter in time, so they had us do theirs as well, and we were happy to help them with that. But it's a very complicated process. So as a fiduciary, you're responsible for this stuff, and that's why I wanted to ask you about this and bring it up to people. If you don't remember doing this for June 1st of 2023, you probably didn't, and so you probably have some liability there, and I just want to make sure people were aware of that potential liability.
Can I just add there that, as I mentioned probably a couple of times now, this is an annual reporting requirement. So in the new year, you can, if you're fully insured, you can expect to start receiving surveys from your carriers so that they can make the June 1, 2024 filing for the 2023 calendar year. Don't ignore those emails. If it respond, it may be a pain, but respond to those surveys. Because it's going to be a lot easier on you if the carrier does the filing for you than if you have to do it yourself, or you have to go out and try to find someone else to do it for you. One of the reasons the carriers are sending out the surveys is there's some key data that must be filed that they don't have access to, and that is the breakdown in premium costs between employer and employee. That's why they're sending out those surveys. They don't know, for example, that the employer pays $400 a month for the coverage, and the employee pays $100 a month. They don't know those numbers. And so they are reaching out to the employers to calculate those numbers, provide it to the carriers, and then the carriers can file it along with the other data that they're filing on your behalf. That's what the surveys are all about.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Let's talk about some recent disclosure and transparency litigation. Can you give us some highlights?
A key buzzword in the healthcare regulatory arena these days is transparency. Many of the changes brought about by the CAA, as well as the earlier transparency and coverage final rule, were about transparency. They want participants and beneficiaries to be good consumers. There are various aspects to the transparency mandates, but a big push is to give participants the ability, when feasible, to shop in advance for medical services and to know in advance what their treatment might cost them. One example of this is the online price comparison tool, although it goes by different names depending on who's talking about it, which is already partly in effect and will go fully into effect next year. And using this tool, it allows participants to determine upfront how much a particular procedure will cost if they seek out either an in-network provider or an out-of-network provider. But all this transparency could also result in litigation, because some of the data is public and third parties can access it and study it for potential legal issues.
Yeah, and we actually just for our self-funded clients, we recently had to go through this, and our TPA that we work with, of course, they had to go out and find an entity that actually does that. So we just recently sent out information to our clients, and guess what? There was an additional cost to that. It wasn't really a cost to the administrator because they weren't doing the work. They had to subscribe to a service that would do this for them. So they had to pay not a lot, but a little bit of money per employee per month, but it's still an additional cost. So keep in mind that this type of legislation could result in you having to pay a little bit more administrative expense in order to meet this, but it's a lot less to pay that amount per employee per month generally than it is to deal with the penalties if you do not comply, which I believe are $100 per day per affected beneficiary, which means all your plan members, not just your employees. So that can be a lot of money when you total a number of days that we're talking about here.
Being a fiduciary is an important task. There are many new legal requirements that are attaching to the administration of health plans, and it is responsibility of fiduciaries to make certain that those legal standards are met. As we've emphasized a couple of times here today, you don't have to do all the work yourself, but you do have to oversee it and make certain it's happening.
Right.
And if you fail to do so, then there could be consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there a trend toward more litigation, do you think, involving health and welfare plans and fiduciary duties? I mean, I recently read an article that a national employer is suing Aetna for breaching its fiduciary duties in approving and paying false, fraudulent, and improper claims, and for withholding information that would allow the plans to review those practices. What are your thoughts on this new trend?
Well, I'm going to break this down into two parts. And the first one is with regard to trends, I will say that it is anticipated that this might in fact occur. Apparently, in the retirement plan arena, after some new legislation came out requiring additional disclosures, they had an increase or an uptick in the number of claims that were brought against plan fiduciaries over, I think in particular, excessive fees. And so we did see increases in retirement plan litigation. And they are anticipating, or some people in the industry are anticipating, that as a result of the new transparency requirements, and as well as the new service provider disclosure requirements, that we may see a similar uptick in litigation in the health and welfare field, where they start looking at the fees that are being charged and they start looking to make certain that the fees are reasonable and that the services provided are reasonable, which just emphasizes a fiduciary's obligation to not only choose a service provider correctly, but monitor a service provider and making sure you're getting reasonable services for reasonable fees. Now, there has been a case pending that an employer brought against Aetna. It's still at the pleading stage, so the details haven't really been worked out. But as I understand it, the allegations are that Aetna was retained to act as an administrator of a self-funded plan, not in its capacity as an insurance company, but as its capacity as an ASO to administer the claims in a self-funded plan. And the employer allegedly became dissatisfied with the services that they were receiving. They felt that Aetna was not processing claims and using the same level of scrutiny in the self-funded side of its business as it applied to the insured side of its business, that it was overpaying claims, perhaps, or that it was paying duplicative claims. And then when they went to audit Aetna, they didn't get the data that they thought that they were entitled to. What this reminds us of is that it is an ongoing responsibility of plan fiduciaries to make certain that their service providers are doing their jobs and are properly administering the plan and consistent with what their designated job function is, and that they have the ability and the capacity to audit their service providers as necessary to make certain that all of those fiduciary functions we talked about at the beginning, particularly the duty of loyalty and the duty of prudence, as well as the duty to administer according to the plan terms, are all being followed by the plan fiduciaries, including to the extent that service providers have been hired to help satisfy some of those administrative steps that are tied to those fiduciary functions.
Well, thanks for that. And I'm sure we'll be hearing more about the Aetna case and other cases that will, I'm sure, be in the news in the foreseeable future. So, are there any more takeaways that you'd like to share about this in general?
You know, and just to remind everyone, know what your legal responsibilities are. Know what your legal obligations are as a fiduciary. Have a plan of action, and if you need support, reach out and ask for it. There are educational tools available for you. There are resources, and consultants and advisors who are available to you to help you work through these processes.
Yeah, and what are your suggestions for plan fiduciaries, basically to stay out of trouble and do the right things?
Remember what your key fiduciary obligations are, because all of the steps kind of emanate from those four items that we mentioned at the beginning: the duty of loyalty, the duty of prudence, the duty to diversify investments, and the duty to administer the plan according to plan terms. Everything else you're doing is all tied to those four fundamental functions. So when when a question comes up, a decision is being made, see how it might play into those functions and how you can satisfy those functions when you're making decisions, taking actions, and going forward.
Well, thank you for that. I want to close with something that we talked about earlier, but I want to just bring it on home again because it's so important. if fiduciaries don't do the right thing, can you summarize again what you talked about earlier? What can they be facing as far as, you know, any types of actions or penalties or anything like that? What can they look forward to if they do the wrong thing?
Well, there are a variety of things that they could, I'll put in quotes, look forward to, close quote, because I'm not sure they're really going to look forward to it. But so they could be removed from their position. They could face civil penalties. They could face criminal penalties. They could face being named individually in a lawsuit for breach of fiduciary duties. A participant who loses money as a result of a breach of fiduciary duty could recover the lost benefit as well as interest. And they may also be able to sue for attorney's fees, which would be discretionary with the court. So you don't want to be on the receiving end of one of these lawsuits. And I would also say, if you are on the receiving end of a lawsuit, it's also, even if you ultimately win the lawsuit, because you can establish you acted with prudence, it's a frustrating process to go through. It's an expensive process to go through. It's a public process to go through. You don't want to be there. Even if you're on the receiving end of an audit, even if you, you know, come out really, really clean in your audit, it's still a hassle. It's still a lot of work. It's still a lot of stress. You can't avoid all audits. Eventually, they're going to find you if it, as it were, you know, as part of their, because they, you know, they pick employers just out of the blue periodically.
Right.
But one of the things that will lead to an audit is complaints. And so you want to run your operation cleanly and with consistent with fiduciary obligations, so that you're, you know, keeping your participants happy and satisfied and feeling that their benefits are going to be there for them when they need them. And that's going to be less likely to lead to complaints, which is less likely to lead to an audit, which is less likely to lead to penalties, lawsuits, et cetera.
Well, thank you very much for being my guest today and for all of this wonderful and valuable insights and information as always. Thank you very much.
It's always my pleasure. I really enjoy these chats and putting our heads together and using the experiences we've both had over a few years of practice in this field and bringing that to bear and sharing it with people.
Yeah, for sure. Well, for our listeners, we have a real treat coming to you this season. Marilyn's going to be coming back again very quickly here to be on a panel about preparing for open enrollment. And she will also be part of that panel I mentioned earlier in October on the Department of Labor cybersecurity guidance. Marilyn, thanks in advance for being part of these upcoming podcasts as well.
I'm really looking forward to it, Dorothy. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We love having you here. If anyone would like to reach out to you, how can they do that?
My email is marilyn@monahanlawoffice.com.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Until next time, for all of our listeners, thanks for helping us make our Benefits Executive Roundtable podcast a success. And to all of you out there, please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Benefits Executive Roundtable. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for compliance tips, cost containment ideas, new trends, and decision-making tools. This podcast is produced by Advanced Benefit Consulting, Anaheim, California. All views expressed are those of the host or interviewees and not necessarily those of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Information contained herein should not be construed as legal advice. We always recommend that you consult with your legal counsel as situations do vary. Ms. Koshu can be reached at 714-693-9754 extension 3. Toll free at 866-658-3835 or visit our website at advancedbenefitconsulting.com.